Chapter 17. A Sluggish Memory. Late in the afternoon, a few days after New Year, Harry, Ron and Ginny lined up beside the kitchen fire to return to Hogwarts. The Ministry had arranged this one-off connection to the flu network to return students quickly and safely to the school. Only Mrs. Weasley was there to say goodbye, as Mr. Weasley, Fred, George, Bill and Fleur were all at work. Mrs. Weasley dissolved into tears at the moment of parting. Admittedly, it took very little to set her off lately. She had been crying on and off ever since Percy had stormed from the house on Christmas Day with his glasses splattered with mashed parsnip, for which Fred, George and Ginny all claimed credit.
"Don't cry, Mum," said Ginny,
patting her on the back as Mrs. Weasley sobbed into her shoulder.
"It's okay."
"Yeah, don't worry about us," said Ron, permitting his mother to plant a very wet kiss on his cheek. "Or about Percy. He's such a prat, it's not really a loss, is it?" Mrs. Weasley sobbed harder than ever as she enfolded Harry in her arms.
"Promise me you'll look after yourself. Stay out of trouble."
"I always do, Mrs. Weasley," said Harry. "I like a quiet life. You know me." She gave a watery chuckle and stood back.
"Be good, then, all of you."
Harry stepped into the emerald fire and shouted, "Hogwarts!" He had one last fleeting view of the Weasley's kitchen and Mrs. Weasley's tearful face before the flames engulfed him. Spinning very fast, he caught blurred glimpses of other wizarding rooms, which were whipped out of sight before he could get a proper look. Then he was slowing down, finally stopping squarely in the fireplace in Professor McGonagall's office. She barely glanced up from her work as he clambered out over the grate.
"Evening, Potter. Try not to get too much ash on the carpet."
"No, Professor."
Harry straightened his glasses and flattened his hair as Ron came spinning into view. When Ginny had arrived, all three of them trooped out of McGonagall's office and off towards Gryffindor Tower. Harry glanced out of the corridor windows as they passed. The sun was already sinking over grounds carpeted in deeper snow than had lain over the Burrow Garden. In the distance, he could see Hagrid feeding Buckbeak in front of his cabin.
"Baubles,"
said Ron confidently, when they reached the fat lady, who was looking rather paler than usual, and winced at his loud voice.
"No,"
she said.
"What do you mean, no?"
"There is a new password," she said, "and please don't shout."
"But we've been away. How are we supposed to—"
"Harry, Ginny!"
Hermione was hurrying towards them, very pink-faced and wearing a cloak, hat and gloves.
"I got back a couple of hours ago. I've just been down to visit Hagrid and Witherwings," she said breathlessly. "Did you have a good Christmas?"
"Yeah," said Ron at once.
"Pretty eventful. Rufus Scrim—"
"I've got something for you, Harry,"
said Hermione, neither looking at Ron nor giving any sign that she had heard him.
"Oh, hang on. Password. Abstinence."
"Precisely,"
said the fat lady in a feeble voice, and swung forwards to reveal the portrait hole.
"What's up with her?"
asked Harry.
"Over-indulged over Christmas, apparently,"
said Hermione, rolling her eyes as she led the way into the packed common room.
"She and her friend Violet drank their way through all the wine in that picture of drunk monks down by the charms corridor. Anyway—"
She rummaged in her pocket for a moment, then pulled out a scroll of parchment with Dumbledore's writing on it.
"Great,"
said Harry, unrolling it at once to discover that his next lesson with Dumbledore was scheduled for the following night.
"I've got loads to tell him, and you. Let's sit down."
But at that moment there was a loud squeal of
"One-one!"
and Lavender Brown came hurtling out of nowhere and flung herself into Ron's arms. Several onlookers sniggered. Hermione gave a tinkling laugh and said,
"There's a table over here. Coming, Ginny?"
"No, thanks. I said I'd meet Dean,"
said Ginny, though Harry could not help noticing that she did not sound very enthusiastic. leaving Ron and Lavender locked in a kind of vertical wrestling match, Harry led Hermione over to the spare table. "So, how was your Christmas?"
"Oh, fine," she shrugged. "Nothing special. How was it at Wonwon's?"
"I'll tell you in a minute," said Harry.
"Look, Hermione, can't you—"
"No, I can't,"
she said flatly.
"So don't even ask."
"I thought maybe, you know, over Christmas."
"It was the fat lady who drank a vat of 500-year-old wine, Harry, not me. So what was this important news you wanted to tell me?"
She looked too fierce to argue with at that moment, so Harry dropped the subject of Ron and recounted all that he had overheard between Malfoy and Snape. When he had finished, Hermione sat in thought for a moment and then said, "Don't you think he was pretending to offer help so that he could trick Malfoy into telling him what he's doing?"
"Well, yes," said Hermione.
"Ron's dad and Lupin think so," Harry said grudgingly.
"But this definitely proves Malfoy's planning something. You can't deny that."
"No, I can't," she answered slowly.
"And he's acting on Voldemort's orders, just like I said."
Did either of them actually mention Voldemort's name?" Harry frowned, trying to remember.
"I'm not sure. Snape definitely said, 'Your master.' And who else would that be?"
"I don't know," said Hermione, biting her lip.
"Maybe his father."
She stared across the room, apparently lost in thought, not even noticing Lavender tickling Ron.
"How's Lupin?"
"Not great," said Harry, and he told her all about Lupin's mission among the werewolves and the difficulties he was facing. "Have you heard of this Fenrir Greyback?"
"Yes, I have," said Hermione, sounding startled. "And so have you, Harry."
"When? History of Magic? You know full well I never listened."
"No, no, not History of Magic. Malfoy threatened Borgin with him," said Hermione, "back in Nocturne Alley. Don't you remember? He told Borgin that Greyback was an old family friend and that he'd be checking up on Borgin's progress."
Harry gaped at her.
"I forgot. But this proves Malfoy's a Death Eater. How else could he be in contact with Greyback and telling him what to do?"
"It is pretty suspicious," breathed Hermione. "Unless—"
"Oh, come on," said Harry in exasperation. "You can't get round this one."
"Well, there is the possibility it was an empty threat."
"You're unbelievable, you are," said Harry, shaking his head. "We'll see who's right. You'll be eating your words, Hermione, just like the Ministry. Oh, yeah, I had a row with Rufus Scrimgeour as well."
And the rest of the evening passed amicably, with both of them abusing the Minister for Magic, for Hermione, like Ron, thought that after all the Ministry had put Harry through the previous year, they had a great nerve asking him for help now. The new term started next morning with a pleasant surprise for the sixth years. A large sign had been pinned to the common room notice boards overnight. "Apparition lessons. If you are 17 years of age, or will turn 17 on or before 31st of August, you are eligible for a 12-week course of apparition lessons from a Ministry of Magic apparition instructor. Please sign below if you would like to participate. Cost 12 galleons." Harry and Ron joined the crowd that was jostling around the notice and taking it in turns to write their names underneath. Ron was just taking out his quill to sign after Hermione when Lavender crept up behind him, slipped her hands over his eyes, and trilled, "Guess who, Ron?" Harry turned to see Hermione stalking off. He caught up with her, having no wish to stay behind with Ron and Lavender. But to his surprise, Ron caught up with them only a little way beyond the portrait hole, his ears bright red and his expression disgruntled. Without a word, Hermione sped up to walk with Neville.
"So, apparition," said Ron, his tone making it perfectly plain that Harry was not to mention what had just happened. "Should be a laugh, eh?"
"I don't know," said Harry.
Maybe it's better when you do it yourself. I didn't enjoy it much when Dumbledore took me along for the ride.
Oh, I forgot you'd already done it. I'd better pass my test first time, said Ron, looking anxious. Fred and George did.
Charlie failed, though, didn't he?
Yeah, but Charlie's bigger than me.
Ron held his arms out from his body as though he were a gorilla. So Fred and George didn't go on about it much. Not to his face, anyway.
When can we take the actual test?
Soon as we're 17. That's only March for me.
Yeah, but you wouldn't be able to apparate in here, not in the castle.
Not the point, is it? Everyone would know I could apparate if I wanted.
Ron was not the only one to be excited at the prospect of apparition. All that day there was much talk about the forthcoming lessons. A great deal of store was set by being able to vanish and reappear at will.
How cold will it be when we can just...
Seamus clicked his fingers to indicate disappearance.
My cousin Fergus does it just to annoy me. You wait till I can do it back. He'll never have another peaceful moment.
Lost in visions of this happy prospect, he flicked his wand a little too enthusiastically, so that instead of producing the fountain of pure water that was the object of that day's charms lesson, he let out a hose-like jet that ricocheted off the ceiling and knocked Professor Flitwick flat on his face.
"Harry's already apparated," Ron told a slightly abashed Seamus, after Professor Flitwick had dried himself off with a wave of his wand and set Seamus lines.
"I am a wizard, not a baboon brandishing a stick."
Someone took him. Sidelong apparition, you know.
"Whoa,"
whispered Seamus, and he, Dean and Neville put their heads a little closer to hear what apparition felt like. For the rest of the day, Harry was besieged with requests from the other 6th years to describe the sensation of apparition. All of them seemed awed rather than put off when he told them how uncomfortable it was, and he was still answering detailed questions at 7:50 that evening when he was forced to lie and say that he needed to return a book to the library so as to escape in time for his lesson with Dumbledore. The lamps in Dumbledore's office were lit. The portraits of previous headmasters were snoring gently in their frames, and the pensieve was ready upon the desk once more. Dumbledore's hands lay either side of it, the right one as blackened and burned-looking as ever. It did not seem to have healed at all, and Harry wondered, for perhaps the 100th time, what had caused such a distinctive injury, but did not ask. Dumbledore had said that he would know eventually, and there was, in any case, another subject he wanted to discuss. But before Harry could say anything about Snape and Malfoy, Dumbledore spoke.
"I hear that you met the Minister for Magic over Christmas."
"Yes," said Harry. "He's not very happy with me."
"No," sighed Dumbledore. "He is not very happy with me, either. We must try not to sink beneath our anguish, Harry, but battle on."
Harry grinned.
"He wanted me to tell the wizarding community that the Minister is doing a wonderful job."
Dumbledore smiled.
"It was Fudge's idea originally, you know. During his last days in office, when he was trying desperately to cling to his post, he sought a meeting with you, hoping that you would give him your support."
"After everything Fudge did last year," said Harry angrily, "after Umbridge."
"I told Cornelius there was no chance of it, but the idea did not die when he left office. Within hours of Scrimgeour's appointment, we met, and he demanded that I arrange a meeting with you."
"So that's why you argued," Harry blurted out. "It was in the Daily Prophet."
"The Prophet is bound to report the truth occasionally," said Dumbledore, "if only accidentally. Yes, that was why we argued. Well, it appears that Rufus found a way to corner you at last."
"He accused me of being Dumbledore's man through and through."
"How very rude of him."
"I told him I was."
Dumbledore opened his mouth to speak, and then closed it again. Behind Harry, Fawkes the Phoenix let out a low, soft, musical cry. To Harry's intense embarrassment, he suddenly realized that Dumbledore's bright blue eyes looked rather watery, and stared hastily at his own knees. When Dumbledore spoke, however, his voice was quite steady. "I am very touched, Harry."
"Scrimgeour wanted to know where you go when you're not at Hogwarts," said Harry, still looking fixedly at his knees.
"Yes, he's very nosy about that," said Dumbledore,
now sounding cheerful, and Harry thought it safe to look up again.
"He has even attempted to have me followed."
Amusing, really. "He set Dawlish to tail me. It wasn't kind. I have already been forced to jinx Dawlish once. I did it again with the greatest regret."
"So they still don't know where you go?" asked Harry, hoping for more information on this intriguing subject.
But Dumbledore merely smiled over the top of his half-moon spectacles.
"No, they don't. And the time is not quite right for you to know, either. Now, I suggest we press on, unless there's anything else."
"There is, actually, sir," said Harry.
"It's about Malfoy and Snape."
"Professor Snape, Harry?"
"Yes, sir. I overheard them during Professor Slughorn's party. Well, I followed them, actually."
Dumbledore listened to Harry's story with an impassive face. When Harry had finished, he did not speak for a few moments, then said, "Thank you for telling me this, Harry, but I suggest that you put it out of your mind. I do not think that it is of great importance."
"Not of great importance?"
repeated Harry incredulously.
"Professor, did you understand—"
"Yes, Harry, blessed as I am with extraordinary brain power, I understood everything you told me," said Dumbledore a little sharply.
"I think you might even consider the possibility that I understood more than you did. Again, I am glad that you have confided in me, but let me reassure you that you have not told me anything that causes me disquiet."
Harry sat in seething silence, glaring at Dumbledore. What was going on? Did this mean that Dumbledore had indeed ordered Snape to find out what Malfoy was doing, in which case he had already heard everything Harry had just told him from Snape? Or was he really worried by what he had heard, but pretending not to be?
"So, sir," said Harry, in what he hoped was a polite, calm voice, "you definitely still trust—"
"I have been tolerant enough to answer that question already," said Dumbledore,
but he did not sound very tolerant any more.
"My answer has not changed." "I should think not," said a snide voice.
Phineas Nigellus was evidently only pretending to be asleep. Dumbledore ignored him.
"And now, Harry, I must insist that we press on. I have more important things to discuss with you this evening."
Harry sat there feeling mutinous. How would it be if he refused to permit the change of subject, if he insisted upon arguing the case against Malfoy? As though he had read Harry's mind, Dumbledore shook his head.
"Ah, Harry, how often this happens, even between the best of friends. Each of us believes that what he has to say is much more important than anything the other might have to contribute."
"I don't think what you've got to say is unimportant, sir," said Harry stiffly.
"Well, you are quite right, because it is not," said Dumbledore briskly. "I have two more memories to show you this evening, both obtained with enormous difficulty, and the second of them is, I think, the most important I have collected."
Harry did not say anything to this. He still felt angry at the reception his confidences had received, but could not see what was to be gained by arguing further.
"So," said Dumbledore in a ringing voice, "we meet this evening to continue the tale of Tom Riddle, whom we left last lesson poised on the threshold of his years at Hogwarts. You will remember how excited he was to hear that he was a wizard, that he refused my company on a trip to Diagon Alley, and that I, in turn, warned him against continued thievery when he arrived at school. Well, the start of the school year arrived, and with it came Tom Riddle, a quiet boy in his second-hand robes who lined up with the other first years to be sorted. He was placed in Slytherin House almost the moment that the sorting hat touched his head,
continued Dumbledore, waving his blackened hand towards the shelf over his head where the sorting hat sat, ancient and unmoving. "How soon Riddle learned that the famous founder of the house could talk to snakes, I do not know. Perhaps that very evening. The knowledge can only have excited him and increased his sense of self-importance. However, if he was frightening or impressing fellow Slytherins with displays of parcel tongue in their common room, no hint of it reached the staff. He showed no sign of outward arrogance or aggression at all. As an unusually talented and very good-looking orphan, he naturally drew attention and sympathy from the staff almost from the moment of his arrival. He seemed polite, quiet, and thirsty for knowledge. Nearly all were most favourably impressed by him. "Didn't you tell them, sir, what he'd been like when you met him at the orphanage?" asked Harry. "No, I did not. Though he had shown no hint of remorse, it was possible that he felt sorry for how he had behaved before, and was resolved to turn over a fresh leaf. I chose to give him that chance." Dumbledore paused and looked inquiringly at Harry, who had opened his mouth to speak. Here again was Dumbledore's tendency to trust people in spite of overwhelming evidence that they did not deserve it. But then Harry remembered something. "But you didn't really trust him, sir, did you? He told me, the riddle who came out of that diary, said, 'Dumbledore never seemed to like me as much as the other teachers did.'" "Let us say that I did not take it for granted that he was trustworthy," said Dumbledore. "I had, as I have already indicated, resolved to keep a close eye upon him, and so I did. I cannot pretend that I gleaned a great deal from my observations at first. He was very guarded with me. He felt, I am sure, that in the thrill of discovering his true identity, he had told me a little too much. He was careful never to reveal as much again, but he could not take back what he had let slip in his excitement, nor what Mrs. Cole had confided in me. However, he had the sense never to try and charm me, as he charmed so many of my colleagues. As he moved up the school, he gathered about him a group of dedicated friends. I call them that for want of a better term, although, as I have already indicated, Riddle undoubtedly felt no affection for any of them. This group had a kind of dark glamour within the castle. They were a motley collection, a mixture of the weak seeking protection, the ambitious seeking some shared glory, and the thuggish gravitating towards a leader who could show them more refined forms of cruelty. In other words, they were the forerunners of the Death Eaters, and indeed some of them became the first Death Eaters after leaving Hogwarts. Rigidly controlled by Riddle, they were never detected in open wrongdoing, although their 7 years at Hogwarts were marked by a number of nasty incidents to which they were never satisfactorily linked, the most serious of which was, of course, the opening of the Chamber of Secrets, which resulted in the death of a girl. As you know, Hagrid was wrongly accused of that crime. "I've not been able to find many memories of Riddle at Hogwarts," said Dumbledore, placing his withered hand on the pensive. "Few who knew him then are prepared to talk about him. They are too terrified. What I know, I found out after he had left Hogwarts, after much painstaking effort, after tracing those few who could be tricked into speaking, after searching old records and questioning muggle and wizard witnesses alike. Those whom I could persuade to talk told me that Riddle was obsessed with his parentage. This is understandable, of course. He had grown up in an orphanage, and naturally wished to know how he came to be there. It seems that he searched in vain for some trace of Tom Riddle Sr. on the shields in the trophy room, on the lists of prefects in the old school records, even in the books of wizarding history. Finally, he was forced to accept that his father had never set foot in Hogwarts. I believe that it was then that he dropped the name for ever, assumed the identity of Lord Voldemort, and began his investigations into his previously despised mother's family, the woman whom, you will remember, he had thought could not be a witch if she had succumbed to the shameful human weakness of death. All he had to go upon was the single name Marvolo, which he knew from those who ran the orphanage had been his mother's father's name. Finally, after painstaking research through old books of wizarding families, he discovered the existence of Slytherin's surviving line. In the summer of his 16th year, he left the orphanage to which he returned annually and set off to find his gaunt relatives. And now, Harry, if you will stand. Dumbledore rose, and Harry saw that he was again holding a small crystal bottle filled with swirling, pearly memory. "I was very lucky to collect this," he said, as he poured the gleaming mass into the pensive. "As you will understand when we have experienced it. Shall we?" Harry stepped up to the stone basin and bowed obediently until his face sank through the surface of the memory. He felt the familiar sensation of falling through nothingness, and then landed upon a dirty stone floor into almost total darkness. It took him several seconds to recognize the place, by which time Dumbledore had landed beside him. The Gaunt's house was now more indescribably filthy than anywhere Harry had ever seen. The ceiling was thick with cobwebs, the floor coated in grime. Mouldy and rotting food lay upon the table amidst a mass of crusted pots. The only light came from a single guttering candle placed at the feet of a man with hair and beard so overgrown Harry could see neither eyes nor mouth. He was slumped in an armchair by the fire, and Harry wondered for a moment whether he was dead. But then there came a loud knock on the door, and the man jerked awake, raising a wand in his right hand and a short knife in his left. The door creaked open. There, on the threshold, holding an old-fashioned lamp, stood a boy Harry recognized at once. Tall, pale, dark-haired and handsome. The teenage Voldemort. Voldemort's eyes moved slowly around the hovel, and then found the man in the armchair. For a few seconds they looked at each other. Then the man staggered upright, the many empty bottles at his feet clattering and tinkling across the floor.
"You!" he bellowed. "You!"
And he hurtled drunkenly at Riddle, wand and knife held aloft. "Stop!" Riddle spoke in parcel tongue. The man skidded into the table, sending mouldy pots crashing to the floor. He stared at Riddle. There was a long silence while they contemplated each other. The man broke it.
"You speak it?"
"Yes, I speak it," said Riddle. He moved forwards into the room, allowing the door to swing shut behind him. Harry could not help but feel a resentful admiration for Voldemort's complete lack of fear. His face merely expressed disgust and, perhaps, disappointment.
"Where is Marvolo?"
he asked.
"Dead,"
said the other.
"Died years ago, didn't he?"
Riddle frowned.
"Who are you, then?" "I'm Morfin, ain't I?"
"Marvolo's son?"
"Course I am. Then—"
Morfin pushed the hair out of his dirty face, the better to see Riddle, and Harry saw that he wore Marvolo's black-stoned ring on his right hand.
"I thought you was that muggle,"
whispered Morfin.
"You look mighty like that muggle." "What muggle?"
said Riddle sharply.
"That muggle what my sister took a fancy to. That muggle what lives in the big house over the way,"
said Morfin, and he spat unexpectedly upon the floor between them.
"You look right like him, Riddle. But he's older now, isn't he? He's older than you, now I think on it.
Morfin looked slightly dazed and swayed a little, still clutching the edge of the table for support.
He'd come back, see? He added stupidly.
Voldemort was gazing at Morfin as though appraising his possibilities. Now he moved a little closer and said,
Riddle came back. Ah, he left her, and serve her right, marrying filth, said Morfin, spitting on the floor again. Robbed us, mind, before she ran off. Where's the locket, eh? Where's Slytherin's locket?
Voldemort did not answer. Morfin was working himself into a rage again. He brandished his knife and shouted,
Dishonoured us, she did, that little slut! And who are you, coming here and asking questions about all that? It's over, isn't it? It's over!
He looked away, staggering slightly, and Voldemort moved forwards. As he did so, an unnatural darkness fell, extinguishing Voldemort's lamp and Morfin's candle, extinguishing everything. Dumbledore's fingers closed tightly around Harry's arm, and they were soaring back into the present again. The soft, golden light in Dumbledore's office seemed to dazzle Harry's eyes after that impenetrable darkness. "Is that all?" said Harry at once. "Why did it go dark? What happened?" "Because Morfin could not remember anything from that point onwards," said Dumbledore, gesturing Harry back into his seat. "When he awoke next morning, he was lying on the floor, quite alone. Marvolo's ring had gone. Meanwhile, in the village of Little Hangleton, a maid was running along the high street, screaming that there were three bodies lying in the drawing-room of the big house. Tom Riddle Senior, and his mother and father. The Muggle authorities were perplexed. As far as I am aware, they do not know to this day how the Riddles died, for the Avada Kedavra curse does not usually leave any sign of damage. The exception sits before me," Dumbledore added, with a nod to Harry's scar. "The Ministry, on the other hand, knew at once that this was a wizard's murder. They also knew that a convicted Muggle-hater lived across the valley from the Riddle House, a Muggle-hater who had already been imprisoned once for attacking one of the murdered people. So the Ministry called upon Morfin. They did not need to question him, to use Veritaserum or Legilimensi. He admitted to the murder on the spot, giving details only the murderer could know. He was proud, he said, to have killed the Muggles, had been awaiting his chance all these years. He handed over his wand, which was proved at once to have been used to kill the Riddles, and he permitted himself to be led off to Azkaban without a fight. All that disturbed him was the fact that his father's ring had disappeared. He'll kill me for losing it, he told his captors, over and over again. He'll kill me for losing his ring. And that, apparently, was all he ever said again. He lived out the remainder of his life in Azkaban, lamenting the loss of Marvolo's last heirloom, and is buried beside the prison, alongside the other poor souls who have expired within its walls. So Voldemort stole Morfin's wand and used it, said Harry, sitting up straight. That's right, said Dumbledore. We have no memories to show us this, but I think we can be fairly sure what happened. Voldemort stupefied his uncle, took his wand, and proceeded across the valley to the big house over the way. There he murdered the Muggle man who had abandoned his witch mother, and, for good measure, his Muggle grandparents, thus obliterating the last of the unworthy Riddle line and revenging himself upon the father who never wanted him. Then he returned to the gaunt hovel, performed the complex bit of magic that would implant a false memory in his uncle's mind, laid Morfin's wand beside its unconscious owner, pocketed the ancient ring he wore, and departed. And Morfin never realized he hadn't done it. Never, said Dumbledore. He gave, as I say, a full and boastful confession. but he had this real memory in him all the time.
"Yes, but it took a great deal of skilled legilimency to coax it out of him," said Dumbledore. "And why should anybody delve further into Morfin's mind when he had already confessed to the crime? However, I was able to secure a visit to Morfin in the last weeks of his life, by which time I was attempting to discover as much as I could about Voldemort's past. I extracted this memory with difficulty. When I saw what it contained, I attempted to use it to secure Morfin's release from Azkaban. Before the Ministry reached their decision, however, Morfin had died."
"But how come the Ministry didn't realize that Voldemort had done all that to Morfin?" Harry asked angrily. "He was underage at the time, wasn't he? I thought they could detect underage magic."
"You are quite right. They can detect magic, but not the perpetrator. You will remember that you were blamed by the Ministry for the hover charm that was, in fact, cast by—"
"Dobby," growled Harry. This injustice still rankled. "So if you're underage and you do magic inside an adult witch or wizard's house, the Ministry won't know."
"They will certainly be unable to tell who performed the magic," said Dumbledore, smiling slightly at the look of great indignation on Harry's face. "They rely on witch and wizard parents to enforce their offspring's obedience while within their walls."
"But that's rubbish," snapped Harry. "Look what happened here. Look what happened to Morfin."
"I agree," said Dumbledore. "Whatever Morfin was, he did not deserve to die as he did, blamed for murders he had not committed. But it is getting late, and I want you to see this other memory before we part." Dumbledore took from an inside pocket another crystal phial, and Harry fell silent at once, remembering that Dumbledore had said it was the most important one he had collected. Harry noticed that the contents proved difficult to empty into the pensieve, as though they had congealed slightly. Did memories go off? "This will not take long," said Dumbledore, when he had finally emptied the phial. "We shall be back before you know it. Once more into the pensieve, then." And Harry fell again through the silver surface, landing this time right in front of a man he recognized at once. It was a much younger Horace Slughorn. Harry was so used to him bald that he found the sight of Slughorn with thick, shiny, straw-coloured hair quite disconcerting. It looked as though he had had his head thatched, though there was already a shiny, galleon-sized bald patch on his crown. His moustache, less massive than it was these days, was gingery blonde. He was not quite as rotund as the Slughorn Harry knew, though the golden buttons on his richly embroidered waistcoat were taking a fair amount of strain. His little feet resting upon a velvet pouf, he was sitting well back in the comfortable winged armchair, one hand grasping a small glass of wine, the other searching through a box of crystallized pineapple. Harry looked around as Dumbledore appeared beside him and saw that they were standing in Slughorn's office. Half a dozen boys were sitting around Slughorn, all on harder or lower seats than his, and all in their mid-teens. Harry recognized Riddle at once. His was the most handsome face, and he looked the most relaxed of all the boys. His right hand lay negligently upon the arm of his chair. With a jolt, Harry saw that he was wearing Marvolo's gold and black ring. He had already killed his father. "Sir, is it true that Professor Merrythought is retiring?" Riddle asked.
"Tom, Tom, if I knew, I couldn't tell you," said Slughorn, wagging a reproving, sugar-covered finger at Riddle, though ruining the effect slightly by winking. "I must say, I'd like to know where you get your information, boy. More knowledgeable than half the staff you are."
Riddle smiled. The other boys laughed and cast him admiring looks.
"What with your uncanny ability to know things you shouldn't, and your careful flattery of the people who matter—" "Thank you for the pineapple, by the way. You're quite right. It is my favourite."
As several of the boys tittered,
something very odd happened. The whole room was suddenly filled with a thick, white fog, so that Harry could see nothing but the face of Dumbledore, who was standing beside him. Then Slughorn's voice rang out through the mist, unnaturally loudly.
"You'll go wrong, boy, mark my words."
The fog cleared as suddenly as it had appeared, and yet nobody made any allusion to it, nor did anybody look as though anything unusual had just happened. Bewildered, Harry looked around as a small golden clock standing upon Slughorn's desk chimed 11 o'clock.
"Good gracious, is it that time already?" said Slughorn.
"You'd better get going, boys, or we'll all be in trouble. Lestrange, I want your essay by tomorrow, or it's detention. Same goes for you, Avery."
Slughorn pulled himself out of his armchair and carried his empty glass over to his desk as the boys filed out. Riddle, however, stayed behind. Harry could tell he had dawdled deliberately, wanting to be last in the room with Slughorn.
"Look sharp, Tom,"
said Slughorn, turning round and finding him still present. "You don't want to be caught out of bed out of hours, and you a prefect." "Sir, I wanted to ask you something."
"Ask away, then, my boy, ask away."
"Sir, I wondered what you know about Horcruxes." And it happened all over again. The dense fog filled the room so that Harry could not see Slughorn or Riddle at all, only Dumbledore, smiling serenely beside him. Then Slughorn's voice boomed out again, just as it had done before.
"I don't know anything about Horcruxes, and I wouldn't tell you if I did. Now get out of here at once, and don't let me catch you mentioning them again."
"Well, that's that," said Dumbledore placidly beside Harry. "Time to go." And Harry's feet left the floor to fall, seconds later, back onto the rug in front of Dumbledore's desk. "That's all there is," said Harry blankly. Dumbledore had said that this was the most important memory of all, but he could not see what was so significant about it. Admittedly, the fog and the fact that nobody seemed to have noticed it was odd, but other than that, nothing seemed to have happened except that Riddle had asked a question and failed to get an answer. "As you might have noticed," said Dumbledore, reseating himself behind his desk, "that memory has been tampered with." "Tampered with?" repeated Harry, sitting back down too. "Certainly," said Dumbledore. "Professor Slughorn has meddled with his own recollections."
"But why would he do that?"
"Because I think he is ashamed of what he remembers," said Dumbledore. "He has tried to rework the memory to show himself in a better light, obliterating those parts which he does not wish me to see. It is, as you will have noticed, very crudely done, and that is all to the good, for it shows that the true memory is still there, beneath the alterations. And so, for the first time, I am giving you homework, Harry. It will be your job to persuade Professor Slughorn to divulge the real memory, which will undoubtedly be our most crucial piece of information of all." Harry stared at him.
"But surely, sir," he said, keeping his voice as respectful as possible, "you don't need me. You could use legilimency or veritaserum.
Professor Slughorn is an extremely able wizard who will be expecting both," said Dumbledore. "He is much more accomplished at occlumency than poor Morfin Gaunt, and I would be astonished if he has not carried an antidote to veritaserum with him ever since I coerced him into giving me this travesty of a recollection. No, I think it would be foolish to attempt to wrest the truth from Professor Slughorn by force, and might do much more harm than good. I do not wish him to leave Hogwarts. However, he has his weaknesses, like the rest of us, and I believe that you are the one person who might be able to penetrate his defences.
It is most important that we secure the true memory, Harry. How important, we will only know when we have seen the real thing. So, good luck, and good night.
A little taken aback by the abrupt dismissal, Harry got to his feet quickly.
Good night, sir. As he closed the study door behind him, he distinctly heard Phineas Nigella say,
"I can't see why the boy should be able to do it better than you, Dumbledore."
"I wouldn't expect you to, Phineas," replied Dumbledore, and Fawkes gave another low, musical cry.
Chapter 18. Birthday Surprises. The next day, Harry confided in both Ron and Hermione the task that Dumbledore had set him, though separately, for Hermione still refused to remain in Ron's presence longer than it took to give him a contemptuous look. Ron thought that Harry was unlikely to have any trouble with Slughorn at all.
"He loves you," he said over breakfast, waving an airy forkful of fried egg. "Won't refuse you anything, will he? Not his little potions, Prince. Just hang back after class this afternoon and ask him."
Hermione, however, took a gloomier view. He must be determined to hide what really happened, if Dumbledore couldn't get it out of him, she said in a low voice, as they stood in the deserted snowy courtyard at break.
Horcruxes. Horcruxes. I've never even heard of them.
You haven't? Harry was disappointed. He had hoped that Hermione might have been able to give him a clue as to what Horcruxes were.
They must be really advanced dark magic, or why would Voldemort have wanted to know about them? I think it's going to be difficult to get the information, Harry. You'll have to be very careful about how you approach Slughorn. Think out a strategy.
Ron reckons I should just hang back after potions this afternoon.
Oh, well, if Wonwon thinks that, you'd better do it, she said, flaring up at once. After all, when has Wonwon's judgment ever been faulty?
Hermione, can't you?
No,
she said angrily, and stormed away, leaving Harry alone and ankle-deep in snow.
Potions lessons were uncomfortable enough these days, seeing as Harry, Ron, and Hermione had to share a desk. Today, Hermione moved her cauldron around the table so that she was close to Ernie and ignored both Harry and Ron.
"What have you done?" Ron muttered to Harry, looking at Hermione's haughty profile.
But before Harry could answer, Slughorn was calling for silence from the front of the room.
Settle down, please. Quickly now, lots of work to get through this afternoon. Gulpalot's third law, who can tell me? But Miss Granger can, of course.
Hermione recited at top speed.
Gulpalot's third law states that the antidote for a blended poison will be equal to more than the sum of the antidotes for each of the separate components.
Precisely, beamed Slughorn.
10 points for Gryffindor. Now, if we accept Gulpalot's third law as true...
Harry was going to have to take Slughorn's word for it that Gulpalot's third law was true, because he had not understood any of it. Nobody apart from Hermione seemed to be following what Slughorn said next, either.
Which means, of course, that assuming we have achieved correct identification of the potion's ingredients by Scarpin's Revella spell, our primary aim is not the relatively simple one of selecting antidotes to those ingredients in and of themselves, but to find that added component which will, by an almost alchemical process, transform these disparate elements.
Ron was sitting beside Harry with his mouth half open, doodling absently on his new copy of Advanced Potion Making. Ron kept forgetting that he could no longer rely on Hermione to help him out of trouble when he failed to grasp what was going on.
"And so," finished Slughorn, "I want each of you to come and take one of these files from my desk. You are to create an antidote for the poison within it before the end of the lesson. Good luck, and don't forget your protective gloves."
Hermione had left her stool and was halfway towards Slughorn's desk before the rest of the class had realized it was time to move, and by the time Harry, Ron, and Ernie returned to the table, she had already tipped the contents of her file into her cauldron and was kindling a fire underneath it.
"It's a shame that the Prince won't be able to help you much with this, Harry," she said brightly as she straightened up. "You have to understand the principles involved this time. No shortcuts or cheats."
Annoyed, Harry uncorked the poison he had taken from Slughorn's desk, which was a garish shade of pink, tipped it into his cauldron, and lit a fire underneath it. He did not have the faintest idea what he was supposed to do next. He glanced at Ron, who was now standing there looking rather gormless, having copied everything Harry had done.
"You sure the Prince hasn't got any tips?" Ron muttered to Harry.
Harry pulled out his trusty copy of Advanced Potion-Making and turned to the chapter on antidotes. There was Gulpalot's third law, stated word for word as Hermione had recited it, but not a single illuminating note in the Prince's hand to explain what it meant. Apparently the Prince, like Hermione, had had no difficulty understanding it. "Nothing," said Harry gloomily. Hermione was now waving her wand enthusiastically over her cauldron. Unfortunately, they could not copy the spell she was doing, because she was now so good at non-verbal incantations that she did not need to say the words aloud. Ernie Macmillan, however, was muttering "Specialis Revelio" over his cauldron, which sounded impressive, so Harry and Ron hastened to imitate him. It took Harry only 5 minutes to realize that his reputation as the best potion-maker in the class was crashing around his ears. Slughorn had peered hopefully into his cauldron on his first circuit of the dungeon, preparing to exclaim in delight as he usually did, and instead had withdrawn his head hastily, coughing as the smell of bad eggs overwhelmed him. Hermione's expression could not have been any smugger. She had loathed being outperformed in every potions class. She was now decanting the mysteriously separated ingredients of her poison into 10 different crystal phials. More to avoid watching this irritating sight than anything else, Harry bent over the Half-Blood Prince's book and turned a few pages with unnecessary force. And there it was, scrawled right across a long list of antidotes. "Just shove a bezoar down their throats." Harry stared at these words for a moment. Hadn't he once, long ago, heard of bezoars? Hadn't Snape mentioned them in their first ever potions lesson? "A stone taken from the stomach of a goat, which will protect from most poisons." It was not an answer to the Gulpalot problem, and had Snape still been their teacher, Harry would not have dared do it. But this was a moment for desperate measures. He hastened towards the store cupboard and rummaged within it, pushing aside unicorn horns and tangles of dried herbs, until he found, at the very back, a small card box, on which had been scribbled the word "Bezoars." He opened the box just as Slughorn called,
"2 minutes left, everyone!"
Inside were half a dozen shrivelled brown objects, looking more like dried-up kidneys than real stones. Harry seized one, put the box back in the cupboard, and hurried back to his cauldron.
"Time's up!" called Slughorn genially. "Well, let's see how you've done. Blaze, what have you got for me?"
Slowly Slughorn moved around the room, examining the various antidotes. Nobody had finished the task, although Hermione was trying to cram a few more ingredients into her bottle before Slughorn reached her. Ron had given up completely and was merely trying to avoid breathing in the putrid fumes issuing from his cauldron. Harry stood there waiting, the bezoar clutched in a slightly sweaty hand. Slughorn reached their table last. He sniffed Ernie's potion and passed on to Ron's with a grimace. He did not linger over Ron's cauldron, but backed away swiftly, retching slightly.
"And you, Harry?" he said. "What have you got to show me?"
Harry held out his hand, the bezoar sitting on his palm. Slughorn looked down at it for a full 10 seconds. Harry wondered for a moment whether he was going to shout at him. Then he threw back his head and roared with laughter.
"You've got a nerve, boy!"
he boomed, taking the bezoar and holding it up so that the class could see it.
"Oh, you're like your mother. Well, I can't fault you. A bezoar would certainly act as an antidote to all these potions."
Hermione, who was sweaty-faced and had soot on her nose, looked livid. Her half-finished antidote, comprising 52 ingredients, including a chunk of her own hair, bubbled sluggishly behind Slughorn, who had eyes for nobody but Harry.
"And you thought of a bezoar all by yourself, did you, Harry?"
she asked through gritted teeth.
"That's the individual spirit a real potion-maker needs," said Slughorn happily, before Harry could reply. "Just like his mother. She had the same intuitive grasp of potion-making. It's undoubtedly from Lily he gets it. Yes, Harry, yes, if you've got a bezoar to hand, of course that would do the trick. Although, as they don't work on everything and are pretty rare, it's still worth knowing how to mix antidotes."
The only person in the room looking angrier than Hermione was Malfoy, who, Harry was pleased to see, had spilled something that looked like catsick over himself. Before either of them could express their fury that Harry had come top of the class by not doing any work, however, the bell rang.
"Time to pack up," said Slughorn. "And an extra 10 points to Gryffindor, for sheer cheek!"
Still chuckling, he waddled back to his desk at the front of the dungeon. Harry dawdled behind, taking an inordinate amount of time to do up his bag. Neither Ron nor Hermione wished him luck as they left. Both looked rather annoyed. At last Harry and Slughorn were the only two left in the room.
"Come on now, Harry. You'll be late for your next lesson,"
said Slughorn affably, snapping the gold clasps shut on his dragonskin briefcase. "Sir," said Harry, reminding himself irresistibly of Voldemort, "I wanted to ask you something."
"Ask away, then, my dear boy, ask away."
"Sir, I wondered what you know about Horcruxes." Slughorn froze. His round face seemed to sink in upon itself. He licked his lips and said hoarsely,
"What did you say?"
"I asked whether you know anything about Horcruxes, sir. You see,
Dumbledore put you up to this," whispered Slughorn.
His voice had changed completely. It was not genial any more, but shocked, terrified. He fumbled in his breast pocket and pulled out a handkerchief, mopping his sweating brow.
"Dumbledore's shown you that memory," said Slughorn. "Well, hasn't he?"
"Yes," said Harry, deciding on the spot that it was best not to lie.
"Yes, of course,"
said Slughorn quietly, still dabbing at his white face.
"Of course. Well, if you've seen that memory, Harry, you'll know that I don't know anything, anything," he repeated the word forcefully, "about Horcruxes."
He seized his dragonskin briefcase, stuffed his handkerchief back into his pocket, and marched to the dungeon door.
"Sir," said Harry desperately, "I just thought there might be a bit more to the memory." "Did you?" said Slughorn. "Then you were wrong, weren't you? Wrong!"
He bellowed the last word, and before Harry could say another word, slammed the dungeon door behind him. Neither Ron nor Hermione was at all sympathetic when Harry told them of this disastrous interview. Hermione was still seething at the way Harry had triumphed without doing the work properly. Ron was resentful that Harry hadn't slipped him a bezoar too. "It would have just looked stupid if we'd both done it," said Harry irritably. "Look, I had to try and soften him up so I could ask him about Voldemort, didn't I? Oh, will you get a grip?" he added in exasperation, as Ron winced at the sound of the name. Infuriated by his failure, and by Ron and Hermione's attitudes, Harry brooded for the next few days over what to do next about Slughorn. He decided that, for the time being, he would let Slughorn think that he had forgotten all about Horcruxes. It was surely best to lull him into a false sense of security before returning to the attack. When Harry did not question Slughorn again, the potions master reverted to his usual affectionate treatment of him, and appeared to have put the matter from his mind. Harry awaited an invitation to one of his little evening parties, determined to accept this time, even if he had to reschedule Quidditch practice. Unfortunately, however, no such invitation arrived. Harry checked with Hermione and Ginny. Neither of them had received an invitation, and nor, as far as they knew, had anybody else. Harry could not help wondering whether this meant that Slughorn was not quite as forgetful as he appeared, simply determined to give Harry no additional opportunities to question him. Meanwhile, the Hogwarts library had failed Hermione for the first time in living memory. She was so shocked she even forgot that she was annoyed at Harry for his trick with the Beezor. "I haven't found one single explanation of what Horcruxes do," she told him. "Not a single one. I've been right through the restricted section, and even in the most horrible books, where they tell you how to brew the most gruesome potions, nothing. All I could find was this, in the introduction to Magic Most Evil. Listen. "Of the Horcrux, wickedest of magical inventions, we shall not speak nor give direction." "I mean, why mention it, then?" she said impatiently, slamming the old book shut. It let out a ghostly wail. "Oh, shut up," she snapped, stuffing it back into her bag. The snow melted around the school as February arrived, to be replaced by cold, dreary wetness. Purplish-grey clouds hung low over the castle, and a constant fall of chilly rain made the lawns slippery and muddy. The upshot of this was that the sixth year's first apparition lesson, which was scheduled for a Saturday morning so that no normal lessons would be missed, took place in the Great Hall instead of in the grounds. When Harry and Hermione arrived in the hall, Ron had come down with Lavender, they found that the tables had disappeared. Rain lashed against the high windows, and the enchanted ceiling swirled darkly above them as they assembled in front of Professors McGonagall, Snape, Flitwick, and Sprout, the heads of house, and a small wizard, whom Harry took to be the apparition instructor from the Ministry. He was oddly colourless, with transparent eyelashes, wispy hair, and an insubstantial air, as though a single gust of wind might blow him away. Harry wondered whether constant disappearances and reappearances had somehow diminished his substance, or whether this frail build was ideal for anyone wishing to vanish. "Good morning," said the Ministry wizard, when all the students had arrived and the heads of house had called for quiet. "My name is Wilkie Twycross, and I shall be your Ministry apparition instructor for the next 12 weeks. I hope to be able to prepare you for your apparition test in this time."
"Malfoy, be quiet and pay attention," barked Professor McGonagall.
Everybody looked round. Malfoy had flushed a dull pink. He looked furious as he stepped away from Crabbe, with whom he appeared to have been having a whispered argument. Harry glanced quickly at Snape, who also looked annoyed, though Harry strongly suspected that this was less because of Malfoy's rudeness than the fact that McGonagall had reprimanded one of his house.
"By which time many of you may be ready to take your test," Twycross continued, as though there had been no interruption. "As you may know, it is usually impossible to apparate or disapparate within Hogwarts. The headmaster has lifted this enchantment purely within the Great Hall for 1 hour, so as to enable you to practice. May I emphasize that you will not be able to apparate outside the walls of this hall, and that you would be unwise to try. I would like each of you to place yourselves now, so that you have a clear 5 feet of space in front of you.
There was a great scrambling and jostling as people separated, banged into each other, and ordered others out of their space. The heads of house moved among the students, marshalling them into position and breaking up arguments.
"Harry, where are you going?"
demanded Hermione. But Harry did not answer. He was moving quickly through the crowd, past the place where Professor Flitwick was making squeaky attempts to position a few Ravenclaws, all of whom wanted to be near the front, past Professor Sprout, who was chivying the Hufflepuffs into line, until, by dodging around Ernie Macmillan, he managed to position himself right at the back of the crowd, directly behind Malfoy, who was taking advantage of the general upheaval to continue his argument with Crabbe, standing 5 feet away and looking mutinous.
"I don't know how much longer, all right!"
Malfoy shot at him, oblivious to Harry standing right behind him.
"It's taking longer than I thought it would!"
Crabbe opened his mouth, but Malfoy appeared to second-guess what he was going to say.
"Look, it's none of your business what I'm doing, Crabbe. You and Goyle just do as you're told and keep a lookout!"
"I tell my friends what I'm up to, if I want them to keep a lookout for me," Harry said, just loud enough for Malfoy to hear him. Malfoy spun round on the spot, his hand flying to his wand. But at that precise moment the four heads of house shouted, "Quiet!" and silence fell again. Malfoy turned slowly to face the front.
"Thank you," said Twycross. "Now then..."
He waved his wand. Old-fashioned wooden hoops instantly appeared on the floor in front of every student.
"The important things to remember when apparating are the 3 D's, said Twycross. "Destination, determination, deliberation. Step 1. Fix your mind firmly upon the desired destination," said Twycross. "In this case, the interior of your hoop. Kindly concentrate upon that destination now."
Everybody looked around furtively to check that everyone else was staring into their hoop, then hastily did as they were told. Harry gazed at the circular patch of dusty floor enclosed by his hoop and tried hard to think of nothing else. This proved impossible, as he couldn't stop puzzling over what Malfoy was doing that needed lookouts.
"Step 2, said Twycross. "Focus your determination to occupy the visualized space. Let your yearning to enter it flood from your mind to every particle of your body."
Harry glanced around surreptitiously. A little way to his left, Ernie Macmillan was contemplating his hoop so hard that his face had turned pink. It looked as though he was straining to lay a quaffle-sized egg. Harry bit back a laugh and hastily returned his gaze to his own hoop.
"Step 3, called Twycross, "and only when I give the command, turn on the spot, feeling your way into nothingness, moving with deliberation. On my command now. 1.
Harry glanced around again. Lots of people were looking positively alarmed at being asked to apparate so quickly.
2.
Harry tried to fix his thoughts on his hoop again. He had already forgotten what the 3 D's stood for.
3.
Harry spun on the spot, lost his balance, and nearly fell over. He was not the only one. The whole hall was suddenly full of staggering people. Neville was flat on his back. Ernie Macmillan, on the other hand, had done a kind of pirouetting leap into his hoop and looked momentarily thrilled until he caught sight of Dean Thomas roaring with laughter at him. "Never mind, never mind," said Twycross dryly, who did not seem to have expected anything better. "Adjust your hoops, please, and back to your original positions." The second attempt was no better than the first. The third was just as bad. Not until the fourth did anything exciting happen. There was a horrible screech of pain, and everybody looked around, terrified, to see Susan Bones of Hufflepuff wobbling in her hoop, with her left leg still standing 5 feet away where she had started. The heads of house converged on her. There was a great bang and a puff of purple smoke, which cleared to reveal Susan sobbing, reunited with her leg, but looking horrified. "Splinching, or the separation of random body parts," said Wilkie Twycross dispassionately, "occurs when the mind is insufficiently determined. You must concentrate continually upon your destination and move without haste, but with deliberation, thus." Twycross stepped forwards, turned gracefully on the spot with his arms outstretched, and vanished in a swirl of robes, reappearing at the back of the hall. "Remember the 3 D's," he said, "and try again. 1, 2, 3. But an hour later, Susan's splinching was still the most interesting thing that had happened. Twycross did not seem discouraged. Fastening his cloak at his neck, he merely said, "Until next Saturday, everybody, and do not forget, destination, determination, deliberation." With that, he waved his wand, vanishing the hoops, and walked out of the hall, accompanied by Professor McGonagall. Talk broke out at once as people began moving towards the entrance hall. "How did you do?" asked Ron, hurrying towards Harry. "I think I felt something the last time I tried, a kind of tingling in my feet." "I expect your trainers are too small, 1-1, said a voice behind them, and Hermione stalked past, smirking. "I didn't feel anything," said Harry, ignoring this interruption. "But I don't care about that now." "What do you mean, you don't care? Don't you want to learn to apparate?" said Ron incredulously. "I'm not fussed, really. I prefer flying," said Harry, glancing over his shoulder to see where Malfoy was, and speeding up as they came into the entrance hall. "Look, hurry up, will you? There's something I want to do." Perplexed, Ron followed Harry back to Gryffindor Tower at a run. They were temporarily detained by Peeves, who had jammed a door on the fourth floor shut, and was refusing to let anyone pass until they set fire to their own pants. But Harry and Ron simply turned back and took one of their trusted shortcuts. Within 5 minutes, they were climbing through the portrait hole. "Are you going to tell me what we're doing, then?" asked Ron, panting slightly. "Up here," said Harry, and he crossed the common room and led the way through the door to the boys' staircase. Their dormitory was, as Harry had hoped, empty. He flung open his trunk and began to rummage in it, while Ron watched impatiently. "Harry, Malfoy's using Crabbe and Goyle as lookouts. He was arguing with Crabbe just now. I want to know—" "Aha!" He had found it, a folded square of apparently blank parchment, which he now smoothed out and tapped with the tip of his wand. "I solemnly swear that I am up to no good, or Malfoy is anyway." At once the Marauder's map appeared on the parchment surface. Here was a detailed plan of every one of the castle's floors, and moving around it the tiny labelled black dots that signified each of the castle's occupants. "Help me find Malfoy," said Harry urgently. He laid the map upon his bed, and he and Ron leaned over it, searching. "There!" said Ron after a minute or so. "He's in the Slytherin common room. Look! With Parkinson and Zabini and Crabbe and Goyle." Harry looked down at the map, disappointed, but rallied almost at once. "Well, I'm keeping an eye on him from now on," he said firmly, "and the moment I see him lurking somewhere with Crabbe and Goyle keeping watch outside, It'll be on with the old invisibility cloak, and off to find out what he's—" He broke off as Neville entered the dormitory, bringing with him a strong smell of singed material, and began rummaging in his trunk for a fresh pair of pants. Despite his determination to catch Malfoy out, Harry had no luck at all over the next couple of weeks. Although he consulted the map as often as he could, sometimes making unnecessary visits to the bathroom between lessons to search it, he did not once see Malfoy anywhere suspicious. Admittedly, he spotted Crabbe and Goyle moving around the castle on their own more often than usual, sometimes remaining stationary in deserted corridors, but at these times Malfoy was not only nowhere near them, but impossible to locate on the map at all. This was most mysterious. Harry toyed with the possibility that Malfoy was actually leaving the school grounds, but could not see how he could be doing it, given the very high level of security now operating within the castle. He could only suppose that he was missing Malfoy amongst the hundreds of tiny black dots upon the map. As for the fact that Malfoy, Crabbe, and Goyle appeared to be going their different ways when they were usually inseparable, these things happened as people got older. Ron and Hermione, Harry reflected sadly, were living proof.